Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Jason.
And today, we're continuing, in at least spiritually, with our discussion of the American left. The first two parts we did were on the history. We did a two-part history of American socialism, the tragedy of American socialism, and the farce of American socialism. And this is the third part of that. Not necessarily chronologically, but spiritually, where we're going to talk about the death of the left. We're going to talk about the death of the left. Anyway, so Jason, why don't you tell us what you had in mind whenever you conceived of this episode?
Well, basically, you gave the very brief pitch for the episode just now. We've spent a lot of time walking through like a crash course of the history of American socialism up to now, and it just only seems right to talk about now with a little bit more of a zoomed in lens, because we're not breezing through stuff we're not a part of, but actually just to talk about the stuff that we are a part of.
Right.
What I've noticed lately is that across the various journals and papers that exist on the left, the best ones and the worst ones, There really isn't like an overall sort of thesis that seems to be popularized by any particular section of American socialism. Whether, you know, like a couple years ago, it was Bernie Sanders, DSA, up, up and away. We've broken out of the post-Cold War moment. It's the end of history. Millennial socialism is, you know, on the agenda for the long term, that sort of stuff. And as a podcast, we've taken up those questions, you know, sort of piecemeal in the same way that the whole left has. But, you know, in 2022, in the post-Bernie, post-Trump, COVID era, you know, with questions like, is neoliberalism dead, whatever, there's an accumulating number of reasons to talk about, like, the left in aggregate complex form. You know, from the bird's eye view, at least
right.
To try to. And I think we probably should recognize that we will be wrong a lot and miss a lot and one day look back on this and wonder what we were thinking.
Right. And I would say that, like, when we talk about this particular moment in the history of American socialism, it would be artificial to separate it from the moment that preceded it, being the pre-2016 left, which I think is the scaffolding upon which the post-2016 left is built, or lack thereof. Lack of scaffolding, that is. I mean, I think that from the death of the microsect has grown the same sect-like tendencies in American politics, but taken out of a political organization and lived online and within caucuses and the DSA. So it's as though the microsect hasn't really died. It's just given up its independence.
It's the sublation of the microsect is what we're really talking about.
So we have microsects within the DSA that act as caucuses, and then we have the nanosects, which are just one or two people all over Twitter calling each other, you know, red browns, revisionists, social fascists, whatever.
Well, there's definitely, I think there's, a little, like, what do they call them? Micro-niche internet celebrities or whatever, who have, like, a bunch of followers and...
Right. Kind of build up their own little sects around them.
We'll shit-talk other people for not, like, agreeing with them about everything or whatever. And there's also, like, basically just, like, internet friend groups who act like nanosects. There's IRL friend groups that are basically sort of the remnants of dissolved microsects that look and act a lot like nanosects. And there's definitely some recurrence of these dissolved microsects into the DSA acting and looking a lot like, microsects in the form of caucuses in DSA. But I do have to say that so far, I was very worried, actually, that the way that caucuses were going for a while in DSA felt like it was just going to be an ossification of this microsect tendency. I've actually been surprised about at how fluid and secondary the caucuses have proved to be. They seem to be pretty, you know, up and down, rise and fall, and changing membership, changing, you know, leadership. Some appear and then disappear, and then they don't just like instantly roll over into another like name or something like that. You know,
yeah, they seem to pop up and disappear just as quickly.
Yeah,
like regularly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so they definitely have many of the negative characteristics that, you know, microsects often have, but they do seem to be very fluid and don't have that the negative dynamic of ossification. And I think a major part of that is they don't have independent funding source. And I think the economics of the microsect is a major part of its problem, that its leadership have to reproduce their own existence. And that means getting dues money. And these caucuses don't have that dynamic. They don't have that function.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we've always talked about with the ISO, with it being sort of a multi-level marketing socialism, you know, MLM, where, you know, we were basically, you know, the Avon ladies of of Haymarket and
said... Well, that's going to definitely be one for the record books in terms of regrettable choices of words.
Whatever you can say about the shortcomings of the caucuses within the DSA, at least they're not operating on that,
right?
You know, for profit or not for profit. I mean, sort of just like existing to perpetuate the sect, by funding it through paper sales and tablings and recruiting members and whatnot.
Yeah, I think like so that's something I think we rightly celebrated the minute that we felt like we could pronounce on the end of that particular phase. And, you know, obviously it's not completely gone. There are still such things as microsects, but they very clearly don't dominate the political landscape of the American left anymore. And that's good. That's to be celebrated. But I do think that like there are some huge, you know, new questions that are demanded of us that we answer, you know, to the extent that we think it's possible. Cause I think if you're going to be a critic, you also have to have, you know, more to say than just, well, this is fucking bogus, man, because that's the one thing that's really eminently clear, is that everything's bogus. So like when you said that the caucuses inside the DSA kind of rise and fall really quickly, and there seems to be a lot of constant reshuffling, there's something about that that's probably healthy, right? But there's something else about it that I think indicates a broader issue across the entire American psyche, which is just a complete lack of any deeply held conviction about a road forward, about like an idea for what is to be done, right? The burning questions of our movement are hard to even figure out what they actually even are. So we've talked before about like the spectacularization of politics where people don't have any way to participate, and it's largely like, let's even say believed, but posturing and kind of skin deep. And I think just in an attempt to not always be just saying, oh man, nobody believes in anything or really understands anything or has any idea what to do. At some point in the discussion, what I'd like us to be able to start to try to figure out how to do is at least begin to try to analyze the reasons why that is the case for everyone. Not just be drawing up a list of people who are hopeless, because these people are just reflecting the hopeless situation, at least the situation that feels hopeless.
Right. Like, I don't think that by creating a flash-in-the-pan caucus within the DSA, socialists are doing anything harmful. I don't necessarily know if it's the best thing in the world to do, but also I have no idea what else to do otherwise, right?
Right.
I think that the DSA is sort of like, I've referred to it as like a rotting whale carcass, right? And that, like... everybody that's within it is just sort of living off of it while they can. So, I guess, sure, that's where people that are interested in socialism are going. So I couldn't fault people for wanting to be involved in it and trying to build something out of it that they think is useful. I haven't the energy or the faith in the American left to try to figure out what to do and go out there and do it at this point. But Yeah, I can't seriously fault anyone for trying.
It would probably be worth us just doing a sort of an accounting for what the sections of the left are at this point, right? Like, you know, we have said that Trotskyism is basically over.
Yeah, it is.
And I do think that that bears out in, but that's worth kind of getting into, like, basically, how do people position themselves on the left? I feel like that's a first step.
Okay. Who are the major players on the American left now?
Yeah.
Speaking of Trotskyism, maybe I could, we could start with that. And, it seems to me that, you're right to say, I think that's a really good way of putting it, is that Trotskyism is dead. But, you know, the first sort of reaction one might have to hearing that is, well, I know plenty of people whose back would get real stiff the second you say that and tell you about how they're, you know, the true inheritors of the Trotskyist tradition and trying to keep it alive or whatever. But it seems to me that it's sort of self-identified Trotskyism is so diffuse and shallow that it's hard to even say that it has any sort of coherent internal coherence to it whatsoever. There's no substantial section of the left that is self-consciously identified with Trotskyism, and those small little grouplets here and there and all over the place who do identify themselves as Trotskyists are so different from each other that there's no unifying sort of coherence to them to other than the name that would make it a singular thing that makes any sort of sense.
Yeah. So I share that assessment entirely, despite the fact that there are formal Trotskyist organizations. Like, really, in terms of having any weight, if there's one that's still standing, it's Socialist Alternative.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which
is pretty much essentially the Kshama Sawant election committee.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, that's not to, like, throw stones at glass houses or anything. It's just to say that I think what we're trying to figure out is, like, what do these things actually mean? And I would like to suggest that they don't mean very much in the absence of some really coherent approach for, like, how to build the workers' movement in some sort of with some offensive capacity, and especially in an era of the internet, you know, of the Twittering machine, that being a Trotskyist, you being a Marxist-Leninist, being a Maoist, that these things they don't actually give us any indication as to what a person thinks should happen.
No,
I think they more betray a sort of a sort of subcultural affinity.
Yeah,
and
you put in your Twitter bio. It determines your style of posting. It determines what sort of needless antagonism you're going to posture at other people who barely disagree with you on the internet. You know, I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, that's essentially the legacy of the Trotsky versus Stalin debates at this point. Mm-hmm.
I also think that that's general. Like,
yeah.
You know, that there was obviously there's been a return, like a big explosion of what we could call like tanky Twitter, where there's like it's a really distinct kind of, I think, like nihilistic subculture of people who maybe understandably just what they have to say is send Jeff Bezos to the gulag. And like, I appreciate the sentiment, sure. But I don't think that that's really – I don't think we get very far in trying to assess that. Mm. I think there was a social democratic moment that had like an actionable like Bernie Sanders had a program. And so in as much as people wanted Bernie Sanders to be president, you could make an argument that there's a social democratic program that people were like organizing behind to some degree or whatever. But I sort of think that in the absence of the Bernie Sanders presidency, that even – a coherent social democracy is kind of like left the stage, so that whether you're a Trotskyist because you think 1917 could have gone better, or you're a social democrat because if Bernie was president, we would have Medicare for all, it doesn't really seem to have, you know, it seems to have just sort of dissipated out into the ether in terms of having like any substance to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No scaffolding. It's all affectation all the way down. And yeah, it seems like the trend of the internet Stalinists becoming like a thing is it's more about mostly young people, but I imagine there's all types who just want to be provocative, who just want to like say stuff to provoke other people, kind of like, you know, punks in the 80s wearing spikes and brightly colored mohawks or whatever. It's like they're just putting on a costume of provocation, you know, that, and that's all it is. There's nothing else deeper than that. There's no attempt to build something out of that. Like, and look, you know, we're all human and we all start with our affectations for whatever psychological reason. It's in some place, but it's got to, for it to be deemed useful or not useless, then it's got to go somewhere. Other than just being an affectation, and nothing's come out of it. I guess the most scaffolding that you could say that's come out of an affectation for Stalin, you know, unironic Stalinism, would be the PSL. It seems like CPUSA has kind of grown a bit. I'm not super familiar with them in person, personally. I don't know anybody in it, but they seem to have gotten some more like serious credibility, or, you know, like credible people who are like trying to be serious or whatever about their organizing more lately. But I don't know how tangible that is or how much of a future it has.
Well, even then, like the CPUSA has done a lot to distance itself from its former Stalinist past, along the same lines that the Soviet Union did. So it kind of followed that trajectory, right? Yep. You won't find a whole lot of CPUSA members that like unapologetically defend Stalinism like you will in the PSL or whatever.
Yeah.
Which is a formerly Trotskyist organization, but whatever. So really the self-adopted affectations of this or that sect, this or that ideology, like Maoism, Trotskyism, Stalinism, whatever, are sort of really just a symptom of a larger disintegration of our societal bonds, really. Right. Like, we don't have, there are no communities of socialists or leftist activists, like labor movement. There are no movements, there are no communities that are working together that one can affiliate with. So what one does is just not like they do for music now, you know? You find a band that you like on Spotify and you like Google their Bandcamp page and you buy a t-shirt from them and, you know, then next thing you know, oh yeah, I'm super into like atmospheric black metal or whatever. I don't know. It's like, it's just another consumable affectation that you can posture as and adopt for yourself. And that really is sort of mirrored in the way that everyone does everything in the world, from finding a job to dating to relating to other people that they are of like mind with. Is you find your niche online, you wedge yourself in there on Twitter and in Discords or whatever else, and then that's your community in absence of a real movement or any other real community. So it's not like it's these people's fault that that's what they're doing. It's just the way that everything is done.
Yeah, I think it's really, really important to stress that. I don't share the affectations, although I might just have slightly less clear ones. and I lament the state of things, which has us being and acting the way that we are. But I don't mind, right? You could be whatever you want. I think what we should insist on is that those are false divisions. That's another aspect of the DSA coming into existence, it's been existence since the 70s, coming into prominence, I think has been a fruitful thing for, you know, clearing away some of the fucking cobwebs in our heads, is that there's at least more of a more potential for people to, if ever this happens, right, there's at least more potential for people to amalgamate on the basis of programmatic agreement. And be like, you know, as a Maoist, I think this is a good base building project. You could say, yeah, I agree. As a Trotskyist, I think that this is a really good way to organize the proletarian vanguard for transitional demands and whatever. Like, whatever language you use to talk about it, if it's this clear-cut set of things to do, that's a step forward. Now, do we have a clear-cut set of things to do?
No.
I got to say that, like, this reminds me a lot of the difference between the punk scene when I was growing up and now. It's the exact same. Like, you find your group of people that you agree with, that you want to be around, and then, you know, you're part of the punk scene just sort of by default. And then, of course, then you adopt all the affectations of the punk scene and, like, you know, go along with that rather than, like, seeking it out on the internet and then buying it via, I was going to say mail order, just kind of dating myself here. We used to have mail order catalogs.
The
you know,
fucking
you
buy, what?
Buy it off of, you know, Amazon or, I don't know, where do people buy it? Bandcamp stores. There we go. Whatever. But I would say that, like, you know, the way that I came into being a communist was sort of just because I thought that anarchism was dumb, but I wanted to freak out the squares, man, you know? And being a communist seemed like way scarier than being an anarchist.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I got into it, just by being stupid and 17 and trying to want to scare people. And then I adopted, like, a genuine set of convictions from it and learned a lot of things that that I've come to think are undeniable truths about the world as a result of the stupid affectation that I once took up. So I don't want to completely discount people picking up Marx because they're just trying to be different or find a niche, or like they're mad about something and they want to express it somehow, and that's the only way they can figure out how to express it.
Yeah.
You know, Varn actually said this to me one time. So I said something about like becoming a socialist, and he's like, by way of this kind of way that we were just talking about. And he's just like, yeah, look what good that has done. It's a fair point.
No, it is a fair point.
It's pretty much just wrecked my life. And that's
yeah. I personally have not had good fortunes and my life sucks. And I could have just been like normal and happy if I hadn't ever adopted these political affectations. But here I am. And I have not inspired any good in the world. I haven't like made the world a better place in any way. So you too could be like me.
Been like, I would probably be miserable and financially stable at this point.
Yeah.
Same.
Instead of like miserable and not financially stable.
Exactly.
Well. So, yeah, I think.
You sure you want to join the left? Yeah.
No, look, I mean, I have a contention to make that there isn't a left. Not really. I mean, there are.
Right, right.
Or rather, to put it slightly differently.
There's no organized left. There's a collection of individuals who identify as leftists, but there's no left.
Yeah, like if there's a left, what we're talking about is a collection of cultural sentiments. And I think whatever that means, there is a left. But I think when I say there's no left, I guess what I really mean is there is no political expression of the organized workers' movement.
Yeah.
That is to say that socialism and labor are like fully divorced. And I think that that's really, really apparent. And I think that helps give a little bit more materiality, concreteness, whatever you want to call it. That helps make this all make more sense when we talk about like how the various ways in which people identify themselves and the precise language they use to describe the world is actually really not even secondary. It's really very far down on the list of important questions. The bigger questions are this question of the class and our relationship to it. Like during the September and October, this big wave of strikes happened, and on the other end of it, it becomes very clear that the left is just not a factor.
Right.
You know, like other than to be writing editorials about how we're excited about the working class being on the move, it's very clear that it's got nothing to do with us.
Right.
The left exists in the same way that like people that participated in Hot Girl Summer exists, you know.
Yeah. Right. So I participated in both Hot Girl Summer and Striketober at about the same level.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a thing you saw happening.
I was
on
very
social
happy
media,
about it.
And you were like, cool, thumbs up.
Good job, Hot Girls. And the left.
Listen,
or the working class, yeah.
Hot girls and the working class are two of my favorite things. We don't have to leave that in there.
I think we absolutely do have to leave that
in
there.
Yes, we do. I mean, if this was the mid-2000s, I would get you called sexist. But
dude,
I think now
that's probably
people
true.
Are into hot girls, so...
Man, finding some people more attractive than other people means you're sexist.
Yeah.
It's okay.
That's just not a concern that enough people have. But look, so the same thing is also true. Sadly, we have yet to be proven wrong in the few times we've ever like weighed in on current events and made predictions. We haven't yet had to eat any crow. And that's definitely held true for the George Floyd / BLM summer.
I was wrong about Biden being the next Mao, though.
No, but like the...
I was really looking forward to the landlord purges of 2021. That didn't happen.
Yeah, well, and that's... Goddamn.
He did not bring about the end of neoliberalism, unfortunately.
No.
No, some people think he has.
No, yeah.
But I don't think so.
And they're dumb and wrong. Well, that's actually probably not even true. Some of them probably aren't dumb, but they are wrong.
No, I mean, like, neoliberalism has shifted into a new phase and is not, like, identical to the former phase that it was in. And it might be called something else. I don't know. But Biden didn't
do anything. But I mean, you could say this. I mean, frankly, you could say the same thing about Thatcher and Reagan, that it's not their... They didn't do it. They were just sort of the figureheads of the change or whatever. But I think the strongest claim that could be substantiated at this point is that capitalism is neoliberalism is in crisis and capital is floundering for a new thing, or something new, maybe. Maybe, but it has not found anything. It's not latched onto anything.
Jason, we distracted you from what you were trying to say about the George Floyd riots and stuff.
BLM, yeah.
Yeah, BLM. And yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, just, you know, what we had said at the time was that in the absence of a really coherent and decisive intervention in that moment by institutions representing a really clear and actionable vision, like a program, right? That energy would dissipate and it did, and it was recuperated, and we said it would be recuperated, and it was. And we find that, you know, the BLM moment has produced very well-funded police departments, and I guess you could say that, you know, the like super corrupt prosecutor who is now our vice president got a boost from it. At best, you could say that it raised awareness or whatever that means, right? But there has been no boost to the forces of socialism, however broadly understood, as a result of that moment. And it's really painfully clear in hindsight why that is the case. And it's because there was never even an attempt.
Well, I mean, I would say even more what it was more directly aimed at. I think many of its proponents would say that socialism is necessary to reach its goal of abolitionism or whatever, but abolitionism was its more direct, you know, ambition, what it's more directly aimed at, right? More explicitly. And I think that it likewise can be said that those goals were also not achieved in any tangible sense. There were some, one police department in Seattle was taken over for a period. One police department was burned down in Minneapolis, big riots and protests burst out all over the place that were really momentous, like sort of incidents. But the point that I think we were trying to make at the time and that has borne out to be true is this has not resulted in any shift in governing policy or like the sorts of things that those who are in power are interested in enacting. Right. Seattle, for example, just recently had some local elections, and there were two different races where there was a very straightforward choice between a progressive who was in favor of funding the police and taking care of crime that is on the rise and affecting working people in Seattle, and a candidate who is a progressive who is in favor of defunding the police and, you know, addressing problems through non-carceral means or whatever. And in both of those local races, the crime and punishment candidate won. Seattle, despite having had its occupied police precinct for whatever it was, a couple of weeks.
In spite of or because of?
Who knows? the tangible consequence or the what has happened, whether you want to say it's consequential, it's a consequence or not or whatever. What has actually happened is the crime and punishment candidates have come out on top, and the moment of progressives embracing the idea of defunding the police is gone, at least locally.
Yeah.
So let me qualify what I said just there. I don't want to make it sound like I'm morally against something like an occupation or burning down a police station or like, you know, whatever else, taking extra legal action against the cops or rioting or anything like that. It's not like I'm morally against that, but I think of those as tactics to be deployed, right? Where, I mean, rioting is not really a tactic. Rioting is something that just happens, like a tornado or a hurricane. It's a result of social pressures boiling over. But, like, I think that without mass organizations, when something like a riot happens or when, like, spontaneous upheavals that put working class people, regular people, into extra legal situations where they're face to face with the police, where they're doing battle with the police, like, without the mass institutions to back them up, you know, without like some sort of continuation of the struggle past that flashpoint, what it is essentially is just a conflagration that ends up burning up the lives of everybody involved in it and usually results in some sort of crackdown.
Yeah.
If there's no organizations afterwards to fight that crackdown, you know, I mean, only so many GoFundMes that you can do to try to get people out of jail for like throwing bricks through Starbucks windows or whatever. Well, it's not a viable way of doing politics.
No, and we've been here before. Our most recent experience with a like large scale radicalization and broad social mobilization should be our point of reference for what to expect, and what we should expect is very little actually, because
yeah,
consciousness raising awareness, shifting the Overton window, just getting people on board more generally with your ideas. It's not tangible.
No,
and I would make,
arguably it doesn't happen.
Yeah, it actually doesn't really happen.
Yeah.
Well, and I would say that these two things are connected, right? So the absence of the left in Striketober and the dissipation of the BLM summer are basically the same question. And it's why doesn't the left have a social base?
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there's the absence of a programmatic unity, like a thing to actually consider an achievement to work toward, and the absence of a social base, which I think is harder to discuss, because, you know, you look around, you got a whole bunch of people who are socialists and they all work at jobs. And so you have a working class socialist movement. I don't think that's correct.
No, I think that you're able to get the feeling that you're part of a movement because you can talk to someone else on the internet who's in a similar position to you in a different job 3,000 miles away. But that's not like, I mean, the way that these things grow is like in workplace movements where you unionize workplaces in the same city and then it grows outwards from there, you know? These localized points of impact that come from labor unions and being involved with their communities, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. It's I think we get like a, unfortunately, we create like echo chambers for ourselves on the internet. So it makes it seem as though there's lots of people that agree with us and that, you know, there's 100,000 people that agree with me because of this many tweets being liked or whatever, you know. It's just like, and it doesn't mean anything. And I think it's really part of the built-in mechanism for releasing steam.
Right.
Same as street protests, which are defanged even further now by the advent of the internet, where you can put up create an event, have several thousand people show up, and then it dissipates like completely after that with no kind of momentum moving forward because everything is just organized online. Mm-hmm. It's so amorphous. It's not organized through like a coalition of organizations getting together and bringing their membership and their friends and, you know, people that they're in contact with. It's all ephemeral. It's all just out in the ether. It's all on the internet. Mm-hmm. So it's like, really has accelerated this built-in transgression that makes it seem as though something is happening where it really isn't.
Yeah.
I think that it's much, much worse than it was when we were younger or in the 90s, when the built-in transgression actually resulted in organizations being built, like the Green Party, as ineffective as the Green Party ended up being. But like there was something tangible there happening.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just collection of tweets.
Well, to use Seattle as a specific example of this, and, you know, to score a point in the Trotskyist tally, Shama Sawant, in the same election, immediately afterward, there was a recall attempt that went to the a ballot. To remove Shama Sawant from her seat on the city council, and with all of the cards stacked against her in that situation, her and Socialist Alternative beat that recall effort barely by a hair's breadth, but they beat it. And I think that contra the couple of city races, the two local races that where the Law and Order conservative beat the defund. Law and Order Progressive beat the defund Progressive in those local races. Shama Sawant kept her seat. So, that's an example of having of organization with the program. Being like having a material function in the world that can actually accomplish something. Now, you can make an argument, I think, about like the nature of that organization isn't ideal, or the goals of that their programmatic orientation of that organization. I disagree with it. So, we should. I don't want to be in that organization. I would rather be in an organization that I do agree with its programmatic goals, but it is an organization that is trying to build itself, and it has a program, and that is a good thing,
Well, and when it comes to at least Shama Sawant as a political actor and the movement / campaign around, retaining that seat for Shama Sawant, it's arguable that on a broader level than Socialist Alternative has, the Shama Sawant political project has a social base. It has a lot of support, a deep level of support in and out in the organization of the working class, but also outside of it. Regardless of how many union staffers might go out and publicly say, "Well, I want Shama Sawant," it happens to be the case that at the rank and file level, there's a lot of workers in the organized section of the class who can be counted in that social base. Tenants associations, people trying to organize at a complex level, representing more than people who agree with the, Peter Taft's vision for a post-Trotsky-Trotskyism. In fact, like earlier when we said that, Trotskyism doesn't exist, whatever, the rejoinder could be, we'll look at Socialist Alternative. But the popular rejoinder to that is actually SA, I know they don't like to be called SALT, even though I don't know why, but Socialist Alternative, honestly, if you look programmatically at the way that they conduct themselves, they're really just a social democratic party. And that's fine. But so that even those successes, I think, point to the kind of just torturous confusion that we're still working our way through.
It's a kind of piggyback off of something I said earlier, where I said that the Socialist Alternative is essentially the election committee for Shama Sawant. I didn't mean that like disparagingly. I just mean like that's all they have the resources for.
Yeah.
Right.
That's also like, that's the max for what can be done there. And, if I could just wave a wand, maybe I would go back to 2016 and get everybody in Socialist Alternative to give up on being a distinct group and have them all go to DSA. And help transform the DSA into an actually viable, fighting, social democratic political party.
Didn't they split?
A faction of them left, and then joined DSA, and then a faction of the remaining ones decided that the faction that left were right, and have dual membership now.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty wrong with the way that all would have played out. I'm not saying that was the road forward, but that's one of the things I wish we could point to as a step away from the left that we're a part of. I definitely think that 2020 was too late. Like, personally, I'm not going to say this is the regrettable century line, but I think that the DSA moment was 2016 to 2020 because it was the Bernie Sanders moment. I consider those two things to be synonymous.
Mm-hmm.
maybe I'll be proven wrong, but all the Biden boosterism and the constant whipping up of fear about the return of Trump, who will definitely be a real fascist this time if he gets elected a second time. It's just like, you know, it's just, it rings so hollow to me that I have so much trouble taking it seriously. And now if events prove me wrong, I would love for that to happen because I'm extremely pessimistic. I want to be wrong here.
I guess this is our fourth year of talking about what's wrong with the left and offering very little in the way of what we think should be done about it. Because, first of all, like, we don't really know. And our opinions and our analysis and the theoretical understanding of things, just you, all of you who have been listening to us have been watching it unfold in real time. So, like, are there any positions that we could take that we think might be a direction forward for the left?
Well, one thing I would say is that the last DSA convention, you know, in the summer, there were a couple of questions put forward to the convention that I thought were really important, and they got voted down. The one thing that I think would have been a very positive step forward for the left, in the form of the whale carcass that is the DSA. One thing that was good was it adopted a program. The two things associated with attached to that that were bad was it was posed members posed the question that we should make agreement with the program the condition of membership rather than agreement with the nebulous term Democrat, the principles of democratic socialism as conditions of membership.
I mean, that's such a major step forward, politically speaking.
That, so that was a question that was posed to the convention, and it was voted down at the convention. Secondarily, a better, even better question that was posed to it was not only condition of membership, but that this will be held to anybody who is endorsed by DSA for elected office will be held accountable to trying to enact our program.
Wait, and, that was voted down?
That question was voted down as well.
See?
Yeah. So it's those two things, which are, like, in my opinion, the two greatest weaknesses of the DSA. Or two of the greatest weaknesses. Yeah. I think there's probably a top five that we could probably do a whole episode on one day, but that we're not going to because I don't think any of us are even in the DSA anymore at this point. But yeah, those are two of the greatest weaknesses of the DSA, and that would have been an enormous step forward for them as an organization. But in doing so, what that would do would be to sever its ties to the Democratic Party as a sort of like unofficial NGO for the, you know, the furthest left elements of the Democratic Party.
Well, you know what else it would do is it would kick the door wide open and shove a bunch of people out the door. As that level of clarity is, you know, directly antagonistic to a national organization with the only policy be come one, come all, right? So I think that, you know, I think, I don't know if I've said it on the podcast before, but I've definitely said it elsewhere that the only thing keeping Donald Trump from being the most influential member of DSA is that he doesn't feel like it. So I actually think that, you know, it's worth saying why we think that this, why this is a problem, because it's not like that DSA is made up of people with bad hearts and bad minds, but I actually think this is a problem that's inherent to trying to, reverse engineer the party. What we have seen in the, you know, as the experience of trying to rebuild the left in the United States has been to do things from Z to A. So first people come up with a really clear ideological set of agreements, and then they try to make a plan of action under that set of agreements, and then they go around the country and recruit as many people to those sets of ideas as possible, and then they try to take that organization fully formed and attach it to the workers' movement. So even like the most well-intentioned and intelligent proposals in these conferences come about. What they are is they're an attempt to graft on a framework that really should have come into existence after this organic connection to the working class was established, I think.
Right.
So if there is a prescription here that comes from the regrettable century, I'll take personal responsibility for this, but I think that the road forward for American socialism is to start at the most elemental connection and then work your way up toward organization and then work those organizations up toward convergence.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can build a national organization first and then make it a popular institution second. You know, that's just, I think that that's the last several decades. What we've seen is that repeatedly failing.
Exactly. That's putting the cart before the horse in a very, very idealistic way. And when I say an idealistic way, I mean like that they think correct ideas
mm-hmm.
and correct leadership are going to coalesce the best people around it. And that's pretty anti-Marxist, yeah. right? If my understanding of Marx is precisely the opposite of that
yes.
is what needs to be done. That's not even like a German idealism. That's like a pre-Marx idealism. That's sort of like a Platonic idealism.
I was going to say, that's
right?
even worse than German idealism. That's Greek idealism.
yeah. So in the world of the forms, there exists socialist organization.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in as much as we can embody that in this mundane fallen world, we will be closer to transcendence.
Well, that is the cardinal sin, or that is the original sin of both the Trotskyist and Maoist variants of American communism too.
Absolutely.
They start as minority tendencies of people who, let's just call them brilliant. Let's just presume the very best, that they know what should be done. It's not worth debating whether or not they're right. It's that they never found a mass audience. And that's why we have developed this overall turn toward this kind of like vague social movementism, desperately seeking recruits in as great a numbers as possible, because
the radicalizing minority.
Yeah, because there's this tacit recognition that the connections to the class are absent. You know, when the Socialist Party was formed, it was formed in the other direction, right? And if there's this is something I've become extremely convinced of at this point, is that we are at square one with American socialism. So like, I think, you know, we should talk maybe now about that.
That we're at square one?
Yeah.
Everyone is trying to, not everyone, I'll say, like a lot of leftists that I interact with on the internet and a lot of places that I read what leftists are talking about in, say, journals or online blogs or whatever, I see them always hearkening back to like the 1960s, this being a period of like upheaval like the 1960s or like the 1930s, or you know, even a few people like the post-World War One, immediately after World War One, when the world was in just a state of free fall. And trying to draw lessons from there. Whereas I think we're at like before the formation of the First International.
Yeah.
There is many organizations now that call themselves socialism, that call themselves socialist, without any kind of coherent model that ties them together, as there were when Bakunin and Marx were both part of the International.
Yeah.
Probably more, actually. Including groups that both call themselves Leninists that have like absolutely nothing to do with each other.
Yeah.
I think that the big difference is that we have we're not in an era of accelerating proletarianization. We're on the other end of that era where the working class is being de-socialized instead of socialized, where workers are increasingly less and less in touch with one another. Which is part of this whole move towards working online, you know, like working from home and the gig economy and
yeah.
stuff like that, where increasingly workers are being desocialized as those types of jobs, first of all, that haven't existed in any great abundance in the United States for quite some time, like manufacturing jobs and stuff like that. But even then, other places where potential for unionization or the socialization of like white collar workers would be possible, those are evaporating now as well, to much to great applause by the American left, who seem to think that it's a good thing that everyone's going to be able to work from home.
Yeah.
And that we are being forcibly atomized by the pandemic and companies being able to cut their overhead a little bit by forcing people to pay for their own home offices, internet connections, and, you know, electricity.
Well, I would say it stems from a theoretically bankrupt moment where we do not envision, you know, popular power as flowing from the organization at work. And we do not envision the project of socialism as constructing that organization. So if everybody gets a UBI or a work from home option, that's good because that's like less time at work as an individual or whatever. And maybe that does individually feel better, I guess, for some people. But I just see like, I see it as a retreat from the arena. It's not to say you should be for or against it. It's kind of like thunderstorms. It'll happen. The question is how do we organize workers at work? That's truly the only question, I think. So if there was a basic case to make here, for me, it's this, that in every individual city or county, get your ML friends and your Trotskyist friends and your syndicalist friends, you know, certain kinds of anarchists, your Trotskyist friends, your post-Trotskyist, whatever. Figure out how to organize a workers' organization and subordinate all the other questions to that. What we need is coordinating bodies for getting people unions, for getting unions to have rank and file caucuses, to get those unions, at least at the rank and file level, to work across each other's struggles and support each other, conduct basic class struggle political education about the need for combat against the bosses, and recruit out of that until you have a group that is worth telling people about, and then tell them about it. And then you get together, and then they get together, and you get them all together, and then you have a party. I might be crazy, but I feel like that's the road.
I think that it's the only thing that there is to do. It's the only thing that's ever worked.
Yes, if we could say anything has ever worked, it's that.
Right. Inasmuch as something has worked, it has been because of that. Right? And the idea that you can just create a political party with you and your five most well-read comrades and then build some sort of mass organization out of that has proven 100% of the time to not work, especially in the United States, even in places where something like that has ended up having some sort of weight. World historically, it has been insignificant.
Yeah. Well, and the opposite, the
like,
alternative
I guess
approach.
The Gonzaloites did that, right? The Shining Path in Peru, they had their moment doing something like that. Wouldn't necessarily say that it was a good thing and it didn't work, but they did have an effect on all of those villages of peasants that they massacred.
I think that's right. And I also think it's true when you take the other approach, which is to, you know, this kind of anti-intellectualism and just broad sort of do-the-workism of the contemporary, like the current popular left is also just, it's got no social base and it's got no program. And to try to construct those things after the fact is looking like, you know, really, really difficult. Kevin, like you just said about the most elementary scaffolding of an organizational structure is still being wrestled over. And honestly, it doesn't seem to be making headway in the, you know, in the largest group of socialists. So I'm not going to say I know what to do, but I do think that there is a basic theory to test about trying it from the other end for a while and then let whatever the precise organizational form is probably going to be constructed in the process of actually waging the class struggle, wherever that is, right? It might leave a bad taste in your mouth if you think that the party form has already been theorized 100 years ago in another country and we merely need to just do that at people. But it might be more effective in terms of getting working people to raise their heads a little bit and push back and find that they've got some strength. That's the closest to optimism I think I'll ever express out here.
Yeah, I think, I think an important feature of this, like trying to get people together on a programmatic basis and like accomplishing something, that is important to take into account in the way that the left currently organizes, is to take to heart that moralizing at people doesn't for like using language that's out of vogue or like not having like figure out all of the most progressive ways to like think or whatever yet is not useful. Now, that point is oftentimes made, I think, by people who
suck.
Yeah, who suck, who don't accept like the rest of what we're talking about of like you need an organization with a program and you need to organize in the workplace. They are just like shitty. They're fighting a culture war just in a different direction. They want everybody to everybody who calls themselves a leftist to put on trucker hats and win over, you know, some imagined white working class or something like that, rather than being siloed into a petty bourgeois academic sort of social milieu. And they're missing the whole point of the material orientation of the purpose of organizing. And I think that needs to be emphasized, because I think both sides of this like culture war nonsense debate are getting it wrong. But it's important as leftists that we don't flush our commitments to liberation of the oppressed down the toilet when we recognize that moralizing at people is not useful for organizing.
Right. The culture war debates are like two groups of people that are throwing shit at each other. Like, it doesn't matter which side you're on, you're still getting shit all over you, because you're either picking it up and throwing it or you're getting hit by it, you know? It's just completely fruitless, and it's arguing about the negatives and the positives of the like the sewage that's being dumped on us by the bourgeoisie.
Go ahead.
I mean, I was just going to say, I think that, toward that point, I think programmatic unity and orientation on organizing the working class and building up institutions of working class, durable institutions of working class power, like that should be what we should be doing. But importantly, what's absent from that is trying to get elected. I don't think that that's a bad thing to do necessarily. I just don't think that any of us anywhere, have the ability to engage in that, in electoral politics, in a fruitful manner. I think that that needs to take a second seat to, building the sort of foundational building blocks of a left, before we can exert ourselves on the electoral level fruitfully.
Well, that's what the whole Shama Sawant discussion basically was in a nutshell, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, exactly.
The capacity to do that in every city is what's demanded. And if a national organization which has been able to do that doesn't have that capacity, then we ought to be able to examine what made that capacity and why does it lack elsewhere?
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't seem to be, you know, that's my contention, is that it's not that socialist alternative is the national organization capable of doing that everywhere. It's that the campaign around Shama Sawant was capable of doing that in Seattle. They just happen to have a relationship. I mean, it happens, one flows out of the other, but it's not a given that you did it in Seattle, so we'll do it in Minneapolis.
There's a lot of contingencies that sort of pointed in the same direction to get Shama Sawant elected and allow her to keep her seat. And those contingencies seem to be fraying more and more every single election cycle. And I wonder how long that will hold. Frankly, I've heard her talk about this very point herself, sort of saying that, like, you know, winning elections isn't the most important thing, despite the fact that we are very committed to winning, winning elections when we run them. Winning elections isn't the most important thing, and that needs to be, kept in mind or whatever. I think what that
I mean, that's right.
It is right, but I think that that's and to be clear, I think Shama Sawant is categorically the best elected official in the United States, and I root for her every time that she goes up to bat. But I don't think that this is the path forward for building the left outward. I think what we have to do is have an orientation toward labor, and that orientation. I think the first step is having an orientation toward organizing labor, and I will take an orientation that I don't fully agree with over no orientation. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I want the question of how should we orient toward labor to be a central question.
I wish that's what people were fucking fighting about.
Right. Like, rather than that not being a question at all, right? The question is merely how.
Because functionally it's not right now.
Yeah. And it's for understandable reasons. Anybody who has any experience actually in the labor movement will tell you it's very difficult. It's a very not friendly environment to aspirations and innovations and how to do things because of the absolute stalemate of the class struggle for many decades now and the complete absence of a genuinely independent sort of political vision for labor, meaning that the trade unions are wholly in the orbit of the Democratic Party, are actually a critical prop of it. Like, in some ways, you can say they are the Democratic Party, or at least they are a faction in it. And yet, there isn't any other choice. You can scream at me all day and say, yes, but the IAM is an extremely conservative union, and the building trades give money to Trump, and there are any number of obstacles to, you know, radicalizing the unions or whatever, but it doesn't matter. It's just what there is. So I think going into 2022 and looking for something to be excited about, something to be looking for models for how to organize, I think people should look for where there is coordination at the rank and file level toward flexing labor's muscles a little bit. And socialists ought to just be that. That's what we exist for. And if we can't find that, then we're supposed to make that. And if we can't make that, then we don't deserve to exist.
Hell yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The only other thing is I wanted to figure out a way to say that, you know, when we talk about the death of the left, we don't mean like in any final sense. We mean it in a very pagan sense of like death and rebirth. Like I think we should welcome the death of this left because what we really need is a good one, like a plain proletarian left with an aspiration for power and an independent spirit and a willingness to do really hard work and give people a...
I mean, you say pagan, but that could be Christian as well.
I was just going to say that you're really pulling at my heartstrings by talking about paganism, but I also worry about calling for the death of the left and just like becoming another... what was that group? The platypus?
Platypus. It's the only thing that they ever said that was right is that the left is an obstacle to socialism.
We don't need to call for the death of
the left. It's a fact. It's kind of like thunderstorms.
It's like...
That's yeah.
I call personally for the rising and setting of the sun and the production of oxygen by plants.
Well, that's the only reason it happens, because of the rituals I perform every morning.
Yeah.
No, but it's you know, we've talked a lot about this kind of... We've made jokes about like secret society communism, and I think that's actually something about that is basically right. We need a lot more quiet organizing and the building of structures and a lot less propagandizing and polemicizing. We've spent a lot of time talking about reinvestigating the various spiritual worldviews that of which we are a constellation. But I actually think that there's a lot concretely to be drawn out of the intentional community and the organizational capacity of religious groups, whatever kind they are, right? There's also that kind of like ecumenical thinking that is necessary. There's also the like willingness to like actually put in the hard work toward a world you're not going to get to see. All of the stuff that we've talked about over the last several years, it does add up to this discussion, not as a final discussion, but as like the kind of discussion that I would really like to encourage just everybody to be having. And it's not about like counter recruiting from the DSA or the PSL or the Socialist Alternative, whatever. It's just that it's a separate question altogether to me.
Yeah.
The existing left can continue to exist and it will continue to do about as well as it has done. I just think that like, if you lament the state of the left, I think that the the task is to just go construct a different one elsewhere. And luckily, in some ways, that terrain's wide open. Because the left isn't in the workshops. It isn't in the neighborhoods at any meaningful level. It isn't in the building organizing against an eviction or a rent hike. And where it is, that's probably the left you should orient toward. Whatever you think about base building versus transitional programs.
That's similar to an argument that I read one time about Stalin's purges within the military, is that, yes, it did put them at a distinct disadvantage for when the Nazis invaded in 1941. But at the same time, there was no gerontocracy to clear out in order for new ideas to be developed. And there was no ceiling for promising young officers That's right. to rise into the place. Of That's a kind of some bleak solace to take, though, you know.
Well, yeah, it is. But it's only because it's necessary, because the destruction is, you know, the thunderstorm's happening.
Yeah, exactly. The destruction is a fact. What we do with it moving forward is the only thing that we have any control over. There's no saving former instantiations of the left.
Yeah.
There's no reviving them. There's no championing one legacy over the other to its eventual victory. If the DSA is the whale carcass and it's the most vibrant, what is the rest of the left?
Just whale skeletons, man.
It's like the elephant graveyard from Lion King, except it's the whale graveyard.
Yeah, well, maybe, you know, maybe yeah. the forest floor is made out of the carcasses of the organisms that have lived and died before, you know. That's what the rainforest grows out of and feeds on. So, like, who knows? Maybe fruit right. will...
There's exactly. a teeming maybe, ecosystem down
maybe,
there.
Maybe some sort of vibrant left ecosystem can arise out of the, you know, the whale carcass of the carcasses of the past. Who knows? But all we can ever hope to do is to help be the fertilizer of a possible future.
Yeah. All we can hope to be is the manure of history. Judgment comes for you. What you gonna do when it ain't nowhere to hide? When judgment comes for you, 'cause it's gonna come for you. I'm looking at the water, easy season for Charlie. Little Buddha, God got him, and I'm gonna miss everybody. Out of rolling flow, like I ain't looked at a while. Like I'm playing for dust, and I play too deep for being sad. Little as I got to be, tell me your future deceased, would it please marry me by my grand plan? You and you can go follow me. God bless you, work another plan to heaven. Follow the Lord all 24/7 days. Even though the devil's all up in my face, but he's keeping me safe and in my place. Say grace to the gates, we race without a chance to face the judge. And it blesses my soul with books. Grudge me, cause there's no mercy for dust. Ooh, what can I do? It's all about the family and how we grow. Can I get a witness? Let it unfold. We live in our lives, we turn around so ill. Gotta show that you can lean on.